Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. We can often tell a lot about a person as soon as they speak. Are they from Boston, Atlanta, or even St. Louis? Are they native-born? Sometimes we can even determine if they're black or white, sight unseen. Linguistics is the study of language and the nature of language, and that's what we'll be talking about on today's program. I'm Don Marsh, and studio with me is Professor Cindy Brantmeyer, Associate Professor of Romance Languages and Literature at Washington University. Joining us by phone from San Diego is Professor John Baugh, Margaret Bush Wilson Professor in Arts and Sciences and Professor of Anthropology, Education, English, and Psychology, also at Washington University. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Cindy, good to see you.
Thanks.
And John, nice to talk to you again.
Likewise, Don.
I'd like to begin with you, John, if we could. You know, the people who came to this country a couple of hundred years ago were English. So why don't we all have an English accent and speak something like Shakespeare?
Well, the people that came here from England came from different parts of England. And so those listeners who've been lucky enough to travel to England, even if you haven't, you realize that the people from Scotland don't sound like the people from London. And neither of them sound like the people from Wales. And so the settlers in Massachusetts came from a different dialect region than the settlers in Jamestown. And as a result of those British dialects that were first part of the colonial distribution on the East Coast, we have many, many different dialects between Maine and Georgia. Pure dialects on the West Coast, and then because the United States was growing at the very time that there was an Industrial Revolution, as there was the westward movement, we also had advances in technology that made transportation more accessible, and so the United States is really a unique linguistic experiment in addition to everything else we think about in terms of our democratic values. But from a linguistic point of view, it's an interesting mix. And you were mentioning English. That says nothing about the influence of all of the immigrant groups that have come speaking languages other than English.
Of which there were so many. So this country is not only a melting pot in terms of the various ethnic groups and nationalities who came in. The language itself is something of a melting pot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a mixture. Of course, English is the dominant language, and English is important to everyone who lives within the United States or who tries to conduct business here, but there are a lot of different dialects of English in the United States for some of the reasons I explained.
And we'll certainly be talking about that with regard to what's going on here in St. Louis. But yes, every part of the country does seem to have its own particular unique way of saying certain kinds of things. It's really an evolutionary process, isn't it? Language is something that always seems to be changing, John.
That's right. And sometimes those changes are difficult to detect within one's lifetime. It's like the erosion process. You can look at rocks and know intellectually that they're suffering erosion, but not be able to detect it physically. And depending upon the linguistic change we're considering, it's difficult at times for people who are actively using the language to sense those changes as they're ongoing. Other changes are more abrupt, which you can see in slang, for example.
Yeah. Cindy, what about the influence of foreign language? Obviously, we have roots in Latin, and we have it in French and German quite pronouncedly. What about that influence?
Well, if you're talking about present-day English, we have strong influences of Spanish, of course. We have 45 million Hispanophones here in the United States. By Hispanophone, I mean people who are using Spanish in their everyday lives as either their first or their second language. So obviously there's a big influence of Spanish in the U.S. all over, but that is actually very regional. There are different dialects called Spanglish, which are regional by Texas, by California, out east. And within Spanglish, there are two different dimensions. One is that of code switching, and one is that of borrowing. So if you want to talk more about borrowing words, Spanish absorbs a lot of English. For example, a lot of heritage speakers of Spanish here in the United States will say words like tuitear, for to Twitter, googlear, which is to Google, emailear, which is, you know, to send an email. If you go to L.A., you can see signs that say yarda sale, yard sale. So you see a lot of Spanish being absorbed, or Spanish speakers absorbing English. But the reverse is also true. We see a lot of English being absorbed in from Spanish, or English is absorbing Spanish. We see a lot of words like patio, salsa, cilantro, the state Florida, Nevada. There's a lot of English words of Spanish origin that are part of our everyday vocabulary.
You mentioned code switching. What is that?
Code switching is when there are two types of code switching, actually. One is when you do it within the same sentence. Let me give you an example. Just a few days ago, one of my Latina friends here in St. Louis said, Cindy, hoy cuando me levanté, I couldn't believe the rain. And I said, yeah. And so, I mean, that's an example. She said, today when I woke up, I couldn't believe the rain. And so she was code switching using Spanish and English within the same sentence. But we also have code switching all over the U.S. with different situations. A real example I can give just yesterday with my research assistant at WashU, Rocio, she is from Spain. When Rocio and I talk about our research, we use only Spanish. So we'll talk the entire time in Spanish. But as soon as we close my office door and walk out, you know, she's like, so Cindy, what are you doing tonight? I'm like, I don't know. You know, my kids have a soccer game and da-da-da. And so code switching is when you go back and forth with the language, you're sort of using the language simultaneously, but it's more focused on situational context.
John, what do you make of the influence of, as long as we're talking about Spanish, the influence of Spanish right now and what it's likely to be? I mean, you're in San Diego. I'm sure you're getting a lot of it there. But you can go to Home Depot and go to a lot of the big box stores here in St. Louis, and you're going to see signs both in English and Spanish. Where is that likely to take us?
Well, I don't think we're going to end up in the Canadian situation where Congress votes to make Spanish an official language. But it's a practical reaction to the fact that there are a growing number of native Spanish speakers throughout the country, whether they're here legally or illegally. And frankly, the fact that many businesses want to use them or want to work with them. And clearly, when you're working with someone in their native language, they're more likely to be a client or customer than if that's not the case. So, and also, you know, Cindy mentioned the cases of Nevada and Florida. Well, you know, California and Texas, Tejas, are also Spanish words, as is Arizona. And, you know, a big, big part of the United States used to be Mexico. And the part that was historically Mexico always had the Spanish-speaking population. And so what's interesting when you look at diversity among that population has to do with how many generations the family has been here. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, you have, you know, families that have been here so long that the children are native speakers of English and sometimes acquire Spanish as their second language. So it's from a linguistic point of view, the distribution of the Spanish-speaking population and the growth of Spanish in ways that I think some people see it as a threat to English. It's absolutely not a threat to English, but because of the fact that so many people hear it in stores and see it more on TV, and last night, Marco Rubio, you know, here we had the response to the president bilingually. And so those demographic changes are unmistakable if you're seeing Republican politicians, you know, using it to try to woo candidates.
All of it simply enriches our society, does
Absolutely.
It not? Cindy, we have, as you well know, a large, huge Bosnian community here in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the largest Bosnian community outside of Bosnia itself.
That's what they say. Yeah.
What sort of influence, if any, has it had on this region?
You know, I was thinking about that a lot lately. Here in St. Louis, we house the largest Bosnian language newspaper in the nation. It's called, well, some people say Shava, some people Saba, depending on how you use their language. But I, to date, have not seen influences of lexical items or different pronunciation patterns in everyday spoken English in St. Louis. I actually lived in the Bosnian community in South St. Louis by Tower Grove East for about 9 years. And I, as a linguist, pay very close attention to this, and I still have not yet seen a strong influence of the Bosnian language. However, I think it will evolve in that direction. I think we will see some borrowing of lexical items or vocabulary words from Bosnian into the English language, especially with the largest newspaper, the Bosnian newspaper here in St. Louis.
John, isn't that actually instructive? The Bosnians have been here only for about 20 years or so, indicating that this doesn't happen overnight, and it's
exactly.
really part of the whole evolutionary process.
Well, St. Louis is very unique in that the welcoming of the Bosnian community mm-hmm. was something that was embraced by St. Louisans, and I think in a wonderful way. Anyone that remembers the devastating circumstances that affected their homeland and the number of people that suffered, the fact that St. Louis at that time was trying to find a way not only to grow, but to demonstrate to people in need that there were opportunities here has resulted in the wonderful growth of a new immigrant community that mm-hmm. that resembles much of what happened in New York when the Italians and the Poles and others were in and the Germans were going there voluntarily. And I'm delighted that our State Department provided the opportunity for this community to evolve and emerge. And one of the things from a linguistic point of view that we see is that there are thriving businesses in South St. Louis mm-hmm. that are serving the Bosnian community using the Bosnian language, providing yes. a comfortable environment for those who arrived here at such an age that it was difficult for them to learn English. And one of the wonderful things about our democracy is that even though English is very, very valuable, you can have enclaves of immigrant communities that function quite well mm-hmm. and effectively and are economic enclaves using their homeland language.
Absolutely.
I want to go to the phones. We need to take a break before we do that. But before we do that, John, one more quick question to you. How do regional accents develop? I mean, Boston is so much different than Atlanta. And, New Orleans is so much different than Chicago. How do these things evolve?
Right. So our very first comment and question about why were there different dialects on the Eastern Seaboard has something to do with that. The folks who settled Boston, their ancestors from England came from a different part of the dialect regions of England than those who settled the South. And because the eastern part of the country was settled prior to the Industrial Revolution, people got around by, horse and buggy or on foot. And as a result of that, the dialect regions fossilized. And so the Kennedy-esque pa-ka-ka that you get in Boston is very different than what would happen down in Georgia. And one of the things that I hope we'll have an opportunity to discuss, at least from my opinion, is why St. Louis is the one place in the country, and we know this from the linguistic evidence and dialectology, where all of the regions seem to collide. It's where the South meets the North. It's where the East meets the West. And as the gateway city, from a linguistic point of view, It's absolutely rich and fascinating, and mm-hmm. Anybody that lives in Missouri knows that the state is pronounced in one of two ways, either Missouri or Missouri.
Hold that thought.
and that is fascinating in itself,
absolutely.
But it's indicative of all of the linguistic collisions from the rest of the country that happen in our wonderful city.
Well, rest assured that we're going to be talking about that collision that you mentioned a moment ago and about some of the quirks in our language here. We'll also be asking our listening audience to come in with some of their examples. We already have some, thanks to Facebook, but we have to take that break now. Linguistics is our subject, and we'll be talking in the next segment a lot about what's going on here in the St. Louis area. My guest in studio is Cindy Brandt-Meyer, who she is at Washington University, and John Baugh, also a Washington University professor, joins us from San Diego, where he's attending a conference, I believe. In any case, we'll come back and take your questions, comments, and examples in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on linguistics. And for the next several minutes, we're going to be talking about the language that we speak here in the St. Louis area. It is, of course, English, but it's different from the way people speak in a lot of different places. I'm joined in studio by Cindy Brandt-Meyer of Washington University. Her colleague, John Baugh, joins us by phone from San Diego. John, you mentioned a moment ago the different ways that people pronounce this particular state. Let's take a listen to some political personalities and see how they do it.
God bless Missouri, the people of the great state of Missouri.
And may God continue to bless the great state of Missouri.
That's the University of Missouri.
It's just been amazing to watch the growth and the acceptance by the St. Louis community of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
All right, there you go. You just heard Governor Jay Nixon in his State of the State address of the last couple of years. House Speaker Tim Jones from the Missouri Legislature, UMSL Chancellor Tom Joyce, and Chancellor Emeritus Blanche Tuhill from UMSL. So we've heard it the two different ways that we're likely to hear it. John, what is going on here with Missouri and Missouri?
Well, historically, when the state was first settled, I believe that the Missouri pronunciation was prevalent and pervasive. There were others who moved from the east to St. Louis that used the Missouri pronunciation. And because the city of St. Louis was so crucial to the westward movement, the rural dialects from the south and from the west merged in the city at the same time that you had travelers coming through other parts of the country as well. And so it's a fascinating thing that the final vowel change, from a technical linguistic point of view, peacefully coexists throughout the states. But, you know, as you're out in the rural areas, most people say Missouri. And there are parts of St. Louis where there are many people who only say Missouri. And, you know, I'm always fascinated because depending upon who the faculty member is at Washington University, they say it one way or the other as well.
Politicians are fascinating to listen to when it comes to this. I've seen many of them on the stump, and when they cross from an urban area to a suburban or rural area, the name of the state changes. It changes from Missouri to Missouri when they get in the rural areas. No question about it. Cindy, the other example that is most often used is Highway 40 and Highway 40. Uh-huh. Same kind of reason for that as with the state name?
Absolutely. I mean, I hear Interstate 45. I've heard already Forest Park instead of Forest Park. In fact, when I moved to St. Louis 13 years ago, it was an ongoing joke with my friends. Okay, Cindy, you'll be working at Washington University. You'll be taking Interstate 45 and going through Forest Park every day. But, you know, it's interesting because since I've been here, I have not heard a lot of that speech in the St. Louis community. I have with older people, but I have not heard it much with middle-aged people or teenagers.
We've asked through Facebook for some folks to give us some examples.
And
there are many of them. I'll just give it. Joellen writes, it's fark instead of fork, which is pretty much like what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
A lot of people around here speak of Illinois. They put a Z on the end of it. Catty corner versus kitty corner. And some people say chocolate for chocolate. And let's see, zinc for sink.
Sure.
You hear that?
I have heard the sink difference, absolutely. But I've not only heard pronunciation difference with oral production, but also lexical differences, actual entire words that they use differently, kitty corner, catty corner. An example from my home state, Wisconsin, and we say bubbler. When we're thirsty, we ask for a bubbler here in St. Louis.
Well, what in the world is it?
Exactly. It's like, where's the water fountain? In Wisconsin, we say Davenport. Here you say couch or sofa. We also, this was a big one, and this is an ongoing thing with my colleagues, is they'll invite me to a barbecue here in St. Louis. And in Wisconsin, it's a we fry out. You know, you want to come to a fry out Friday night, or we're going to go to a brat fry. But here it's a barbecue. So I think there's lexical differences that are unique to St. Louis, but it's exciting because in St. Louis, people embrace those differences. I get asked quite frequently, where are you from? You know, you just used, you know, or if I ask somebody, like, is there a place we can, or can we go to a supper club? You know, they'll be like, supper club, where are you from? And they embrace the differences, and they want to know where I'm from and why I didn't grow up here.
John, I would guess that a brat cooked at a brat fry is just as good as one kicked on a barbecue pit, wouldn't you?
Well, all of the examples he just gave made me happier to live in St. Louis than Wisconsin. But I'd be remiss if I didn't point out also that there are some unique linguistic developments happening in the African-American community, influenced strongly by the rapper Nelly. And Nelly's linguistic contribution is that he has transformed the pronunciation of words like here, and he pronounces that word very much like anybody else who speaks standard English would say her. So instead of saying up in here, he would say up in her. And the context makes clear what he means, but he has been so popular that his linguistic influence shows up among young hip-hop devotees in other parts of the country. And so this black linguistic influence in St. Louis, thanks to Nelly and his exposure, is actually showing up in other parts of the country. And it ends up being controversial, at least among the hip-hop devotees in Atlanta and Chicago, because they then are conveying disloyalty to their local linguistic norms when they adopt Nelly's speech. And that's a fascinating dimension when you consider some of the racial differences and the fact that they're now exposed through the mass media in ways that defy the kinds of historical linguistic changes that happen naturally from day-to-day interaction face-to-face.
Yeah, these happen overnight, given the way we communicate today, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
In this regard, we have a call from Tom in Afton. Let's bring him in right now because he wants to get into the black English part of this conversation. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you, Don. Thanks for a fascinating topic. Your guests may know about that recent forum at the Pulitzer on the BBC report, the Delmar Divide, that talked about the Delmar as sort of a racial boundary in St. Louis. And I think we could do a great service to the St. Louis community by talking about the aspect about black English, or what they used to call Ebonics, is that I still hear friends and family who are Anglo talk about black English as being slang or lazy or uneducated. And I know Steven Pinker didn't do the research, but in his Language Instinct book, he talks about how black English is grammatically distinct. It has a distinct lexical aspect. And, of course, I'm not a linguist, so I can't speak about it well, but maybe your guests could kind of elucidate that for us.
Let's give that one to John.
Well, we should have him come give some lectures at Washington University because he's very well informed. And I want to thank you for the question and for framing it as nicely as you did, because there are many people who assume that the black dialect is, in fact, a sign of lower intelligence or laziness and an unwillingness to adopt the standard English norms. And many people who hear me don't recognize that I'm African-American because of the fact that I do have control of standard English. But the fact of the matter is that in comparison to every other immigrant group that came to the United States voluntarily, the slaves have a unique linguistic heritage. And it resulted from the fact that when they were captives on the west coast of Africa, the slave traders initially separated the slaves by language whenever possible to restrict or to try to limit the possibility of uprisings through the Atlantic crossing. And then when they finally did come to the United States and were sold, it was illegal to teach them to read and write. And so when they were exposed to English, the English that they encountered was typically that of the slave overseers. And the slave overseers weren't well-educated themselves. They tended to be indentured servants from Scotland and Ireland who in their brogue would say, "The cows be done be over yonder." And if you add African phonology to "done be over yonder," you get some of the linguistic features that are associated with what Robert Williams, who was a professor at Washington University, Bob Williams, is actually the person that gave us the term Ebonics, which for many people has been a laughable construction. But for those of us that know the linguistic situation, Bob's contribution was important because he recognized that the slave trade took place throughout North and South America. There were more slaves imported to Brazil than to the United States. And in every country that's had African slaves, there have been linguistic consequences. And what we're seeing in St. Louis, which clearly does reflect that strong divide along Del Mar north and south, are that many of the residents north of Del Mar do, in fact, trace their linguistic and cultural ancestry to people who were formerly enslaved. And they'll say things like, "he be happy," rather than "he is happy," which is actually a functioning grammatical distinction where "be" means one is habitually in that state, but the use of "is" or the absence of "is" means that it's a momentary state. And yet these functioning grammatical distinctions, which some people say are the source of laziness, are really inherited from slavery and were fossilized because of the fact that slaves were not exposed to the educated norms in schools.
You know, I learned something this morning that I did not know, among many things I do not know, but and that is the Gula language. I'm sure, Bob, that you would know about that, or John, that you would know about that. Off the coast of the Carolinas, that a language, a mixture of African languages and Creole?
Yeah, and I also know that it's pronounced Gula.
So, see, I'm in evolutionary
okay.
process
you
here.
You encountered it in print. But you're right. The Gullah language, which the locals call Geechee, still is preserved on the Sea Islands, right? And so even within the African-American community, the slaves who were isolated in the Outer Banks Islands there were even more remotely removed from English. And their English, to this day, there are museums there. You can go on Gullah tours. And, you know, a lot of this is now taken over by resorts near Hilton Head. And so it's fascinating to see the class differences because you have extreme poverty in some of the islands and absolute wealth in close proximity with fabulous golf courses. But from a linguistic point of view, they were isolated even from the remote regional varieties of African-American English that, you know, have been the source of controversy.
All righty. Well, thanks for clearing that up. I've learned two things today. And thank you for that. Let's take another phone call. Amy joins us from Edwardsville. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi. I'm originally from Wisconsin, too. And funniest thing that ever happened to me was when I first moved down here in 2000, and I was with some coworkers trying to find an ATM, and I called it a time machine.
Oh, yeah.
Because our machines up there had the words "Take Your Money Everywhere," T-Y-M-E, and I would say, "Oh, I got to find a time machine," and they're like, "What year are you going back to?" But I thought I'd get over it. But occasionally, I still have people asking me where I'm from, and my 14-year-old son just loves to make fun of me, and he's like, "Oh no, let's go out to the car," you know, and things like that. So I realize I do have an accent. I didn't think I did, but I do, I guess.
Yes, and we also carry on our prepositions at the end of our sentences, too, don't we? And, you know,
yes.
We'll say, you know, who'd you go to the Packer game with? It's just so awkward for me to use grammatical English when I'm talking about the Packers. I can't say, with whom did you go to the Packer game? It just doesn't
yes.
sound correct.
Winston Churchill would certainly not approve.
Exactly, exactly.
Ending a sentence in a preposition is something up with which I will not put, I think is
absolutely.
What he said. John, are there any parts of the country that are really accent-free?
Well, I was about to respond to that because everyone speaks with an accent. And in fact, very often when I speak to audiences, and I often have the wonderful opportunity to speak to Rotary clubs where many of the members are well-educated and model citizens of their region. And I'll begin by saying, you know, is there anyone here that doesn't have an accent? Would you please raise your hand? And that inevitably ensnares, you know, some poor souls who honestly believe in their hearts that they speak without an accent, and they raise their hands. And I point out that as long as you speak, you do have an accent. It just depends on where you are and what region you're in, whether or not you detect that you have an accent. And so when people say that they don't have an accent, what they mean is that the manner in which they speak does not call undue attention to itself in their day-to-day lives. But for anyone who says that they don't have an accent living in St. Louis, I'd suggest that they get in their car, pick a direction, north, south, east, or west, drive 300 miles, get out of your car, ask people, do you have an accent? If they still say no, drive another 300 miles, and eventually you will arrive at a point of the country where someone says, yes, you're the one with the accent. And so one of the reasons that Cindy and I are, you know, able to study this fascinating field is that the perception of accents is really relative depending upon your own linguistic experience. And I think the previous caller, when she lived in Wisconsin, nobody up there would have said that she had an accent. They would have said that it was people from St. Louis that had the accent. And so there really is linguistic relativity at play.
Absolutely.
Let's return to the phones and bring in Robert calling from Webster Groves. Go ahead, Robert. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question which is neither. It crosses all racial, economic, social, and educational levels, that if you were to talk to your correspondent in Washington about State of the Union, 50-50, the answer will start out with the word well. It's a space keeper that we've come to use as a crutch. Well, John used another one that's become ubiquitous of the younger generation. They're starting their answer with the word so, not so as to therefore, but before he got into his answer, he said so. And the third one, which has become ubiquitous, is to start out the response with the word certainly, kind of an affirmation or reaffirmation, I suppose, of the question being asked. But instead of just answering the question, where are you from, John, he would say, so, and then he'd talk about his past.
Robert, thank you for that. I've noticed that myself and have had conversations about it. But Cindy, you were reacting as he was speaking.
Well, I just was affirming what he's saying, and I detected the same thing with John. John said so, and I actually said a couple times certainly or absolutely. And so I think, yeah, thank you for that comment.
What about the role of social media today? I mean, look at the way people are writing and the way they're abbreviating things and the way they're saying things. Cindy, I'll start with you. This has to be changing our language.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at technology and technological influences in written English, there are so many words that we use that are technology-driven, like I said earlier, Twitter, email, things like that, that are becoming part of everyday English slang.
We're inventing words.
Oh, absolutely. We're texting. I mean, look at the words we use texting. I mean, as a linguist, I'm fascinated by the text I get from my friends. I don't look at the content of what they're saying, but rather the linguistic, morphological aspects of what they're sending me over text. Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah.
John, how do you see the influence of social media?
Well, I think it's another dimension of linguistic change where you find that technology has provided another opportunity for us to use language in different ways. I also wanted to comment a little bit on the previous call because the caller was absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Our colloquial spoken language differs greatly from that of proper usage in writing. And there are important linguistic controversies that prevail regarding proper language usage and improper language usage that exceed the questions that we were talking about previously with Black English and the unique linguistic heritage of slaves in the country and how that differs from other parts of the country. But his observation about the prefacing and sentences with well and so and absolutely are some of the linguistic changes in progress which that caller, who's clearly attending to grammar, has noticed, and which for many, many other people, they're not noticing because it's creeping into the language, my own included, in ways that we're not consciously aware of.
I mean, even if you look at, with social media, with CNN, you look at the use of adverbs, for example. I mean, the CNN slogan for years has been real news, real fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's ungrammatical. Yeah. the adjective should be modifying, or the adverb, it should be really fast. But we've accepted it, and it's part of everyday CNN talk now.
Well, and advertising changes a lot. I remember Winston
Absolutely.
Tastes good like a cigarette should, and people really rose up over that, but it didn't change that dynamic. Have to take another break now. We're talking about linguistics and language, how it affects us all, and particularly in this region, how we use language. My guest in studio is Cindy Brandt-Meyer from Washington University. Joining us by phone from San Diego is John Baugh, also from Washington University. Back to take more of your questions in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion of linguistics and particularly how we are affected by changes in words and language here in the St. Louis area. I'm going to go right back to the phones. We have a number of calls at 382-8255. We'll bring in Alan calling from Fenton. Go ahead, Alan.
I'd like to mention a couple of differences in the way our TV news folks around the country pronounce various things or call them. In St. Louis, we would say Highway 40, but our good friends across the state in Kansas City would be calling it 40 Highway in their local news reports. And also in California, in the Los Angeles area, they use the word T-H-E, the, in front of the name of their highway. They would say traffic is busy on the 405 or we have an accident on the 5. Here in St. Louis, of course, we just would say I-55 or 55 northbound or 70 westbound. Anyway, those are my two comments. Thank you.
All right, it's showing once again you don't have to be too far apart to be far apart, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it also shows that the news and the media will use the language of the everyday people to attract them. I mean, we have President Obama doing that in the video clip on CNN of Obama where he is in a chili restaurant in D.C. and ordering chili, and he said to the waitress, you know, she wanted to give him his change, and Obama says, nah, we straight. And anyway, it's a very effective use of language to get to everyday people. And I think the caller, Greg, gave an excellent example of regional differences here in St. Louis where broadcasters are using the English of the people.
John, how well does the media do with language in general?
The media? Well, it depends on what part of the media we're speaking.
Well, let's stay with television. Let's stay with television. Well,
the broadcasters, for the most part, are speakers of standard English, often from their own regions. But you'll find that the local weather forecaster or sports broadcasters will represent local varieties even more strongly than other parts of the region. But, Don, I must say, since we're talking about linguistics, and I'm actually a fan of yours and a listener to the show,
uh-oh,
I've been curious about your own linguistic background. You're the voice of St. Louis. I'm probably not the only one that wants to know a little bit about your linguistic heritage. Are you a native St. Louisan? Did you grow up there? Did you take special diction lessons? See, I can't even say it. Diction lessons to help your own speech?
Well, I'll make this very brief. I grew up in New Jersey, which some people call Joysy. I don't. And why I don't know. But New Jersey, near where I grew up, was a D's, Dems, and Does kind of state, mm-hmm, and it still is. I think it's just an accident of where I was. My community was a New York bedroom community and a mixture of people, and I think the way we wound up speaking is the way I'm speaking today, just by an accident of geography, I guess.
So what about your first name? Your first name is pronounced differently across the U.S.
Well, it's pronounced Don by everybody I know except my friend Ken Warren, who's from Boston, who calls me Don.
Exactly.
But I respond. I respond. Enough about me. Let's go to, does that answer your question, John? Is that more information you need?
I'm sure it answers the question for a lot of your listeners.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for asking. Let's take in Ben's call. He's calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I had a very specific question. I'm an MBA student at Washington University, so I thought I'd get some inside perspective. And one word in particular has caused some controversy, and that is finance or finance. And I have adopted the finance pronunciation and have been, I guess, ripped by my friends that I'm projecting an academic style of talk, and I thought, you know, specifically about that to settle some arguments, if you could answer that, and then maybe more broadly, the academic versus, you know, outside the academic world. Thank you.
Okay. Cindy, would you like to take that?
You know, I can completely relate to that. There's academic speech, and then there's non-academic speech. So to answer or to comment based on what you said, I think, you know, it's situationally appropriate for you to use one or the other, and we can't deny that we are what we speak. And people, unfortunately, will define us by and identify us in different ways by what comes out of our mouth. So I think, you know, if you use finance with, you know, everyday language, but then in your academic circle you're using finance, I think, you know, it's situational, it's appropriate. I mean, we just learn throughout life to use language in different ways in different situations.
John, I'll take that one step further. Unless you want to comment specifically to Ben, I'll take his question one step further with you. And that is, we do a little microphone check before we go on the air here. And the word presentation comes up during the course of that little test. And half the people come in and say presentation, and half the people say presentation. I have not been able to determine whether or not that's regional. It doesn't seem to be. It doesn't seem to be age-specific in any way. And the other word is harass and harass. Do you have any explanation as to why these two words are pronounced so differently by so many people?
Yes, because we have changing vowel pronunciations. Yeah. So most of your listeners know the tomato-tomato, either-either distinctions. So the finance and finance distinction is a reflection of that as well. When I was growing up and I had a very strong African-American dialect, I pronounced the words pin and pen identically. I did not make a distinction in the vowels that I used. I would talk about ink pens and straight pens, and that's how I maintained the distinction. And I had many teachers that you know, spent a tremendous amount of time trying to make me pronounce and hear the differences in those two vowels. And the fact of the matter is that there are a variety of linguistic changes in progress. And again, what is happening here in St. Louis is that they all collide from the different regions of the country. But with respect to the pin and pen distinction, you can find that in the words tin and ten. But if you took those very same vowel sounds and you applied them to a sentence such as the men were walking down the street versus the men were walking down the street, people don't hear that, right? So what is extremely important in certain linguistic situations is not in others. And as a result of that, you do get some people saying finance and some people saying finance. And that, depending upon the speaker, that may drive them crazy or it may not be anything that they notice at all.
All right, we'll return to the phones and bring in Kathy, who wants to get into this discussion. Go ahead, Kathy.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Huh. I taught grade school years ago up in the Florissant area, and at that time, the children routinely interchanged the words A-R-E, O-U-R, and O-R, and I finally figured out it was because they said them all the same. Now, I'm from Michigan, and so to me that's our, our, and or. And I will always park my car. I will play cards and drink pop. And I think that Cindy can identify with that.
Well, I think you've underscored what we're talking about here is that people have very strong feelings about what is correct or what is incorrect. And like you said, I'm always going to say our, or our.
You know, you just said something that triggered a thought in my mind, and John, I'll give this one to you. We do have a tendency to make judgments of people by the way they talk. And what I'm particularly thinking of here is there is a tendency on the part of some to think that people with Southern accents aren't smart. What is going on here?
Well, the people that think that people with Southern accents aren't smart didn't grow up in the South.
Exactly.
People who grew up in the South feel that they are genteel, right? So that's a different, I'm sorry. The people who grew up in the South have a very different perspective on that. But the stereotype that Southern speech is a sign of low intelligence was reinforced in large part by the movies that were produced during World War II, mm-hmm. where Molly Ivins from Texas always pointed out that you had some, you know, slow-talking hick from the South who projected this stereotype of not being that bright. And the TV show Gomer Pyle didn't help much, right? Mm-hmm. So those stereotypes are often reinforced artificially by the media. But sometimes the people who have that low opinion of Southern speech, when their dialects are evaluated by people that grew up in the South, they're often seen as untrustworthy or they speak too quickly or they're insensitive. So again, there are attitudes that vary from region to region depending upon your own linguistic experience and your own linguistic comfort zone and, frankly, the dialects that you embrace and enjoy as well as the dialects that you find less attractive, if not abhorrent.
And then you have people like President Bill Clinton who would use his Southern dialect to his advantage to, hit home with Southerners.
And then you have someone like Lyndon Johnson that a lot of people thought less of because he was very heavily accented.
You're
from
right.
That Texas draw. Let's bring in
Flynn. Well, I actually...
Go ahead, John.
Well, I actually wanted to comment on the speech of both President Bushes because...
Yes.
That's a fascinating linguistic tale when you recognize that the first President Bush, who sounded like a Connecticut Yankee, even when he moved to Texas, his son doesn't talk like him, right? It's so often the case that a child's speech is strongly influenced by their parents. And yet the second President Bush sounded very much like a good old boy from Texas. And that was because of the linguistic values of that region and also his own desire to identify more closely with, quote-unquote, ordinary people than with those that he went to college with at Yale and Harvard.
And he also
I think the Bush family is a fascinating one. And then Bill Clinton, his own linguistic dexterity is just tremendous. And yeah. He has a y'all index, very similar to your Missouri politicians. When Bill Clinton's in the South, he y'alls everybody. Mm-hmm. And when he's in other parts of the country, the y'all goes away and he replaces it with you.
Yes.
And the man is incredibly sensitive with respect to his linguistic skills and abilities. And very often the people around him don't notice the differences, but he's quite adept at style shifting, which is different than code switching that Cindy was talking about.
John, you've done a lot of work on language profiling, and give us a sense of what you've found in your research on that.
Well, linguistic profiling can occur when someone is discriminated against based purely on the sound of their voice over the telephone. And our research began in housing markets where very often people who spoke with strong accents would call to try to inquire about an apartment or place for sale and were told that it was unavailable, when in fact it was still available. It's just that the recipient of the call made a decision that the caller was undesirable. And that form of discrimination was very difficult to prosecute in the courts because it didn't take place face-to-face. And very often the person who was guilty of the discrimination, if they were in fact guilty of it, could say that I never saw the person. I couldn't tell that they were black, and or I couldn't tell that it was a man or a woman. And some of the work that we do now also has to do with stereotypes about sexual orientation that are conveyed through your voice alone. So a part of my career that I've been fascinated by has to do with whether or not it's possible to discriminate against someone based purely on the sound of their voice. And then the added test when we take it to the courts is, how do you prove that? How do you actually prove that in a court of law?
Is it something that you found can be proven in most cases?
I don't know about most cases, but I serve as an expert witness in many cases, and what we do is we conduct experiments. In the hypothetical example where you know fairly well that the recipients of the phone calls did discriminate because the caller was African-American or Latino, they'll often deny that they could detect those differences when they heard the voice. And so then we begin to conduct some experiments, and we have a series of tapes that we can play because some things are not controversial. So, for example, I think I sound like a man, Cindy sounds like a woman. Anyone who didn't know us and heard our voices would say, yeah, that's a man's voice, that's a woman's voice, and it's not controversial. To say that Cindy is a white woman adds the racial dimension, and it begins to get more controversial there. And so we would begin to play a child's voice versus an adult voice and ask the defendant, can you tell that difference? And they would say yes. And then we would play somebody from New York and somebody from Texas, and can you tell those differences? And they would say yes. And we move closer and closer to the critical black and white case or Latino and white case, and then they would say they couldn't hear the difference. But as long as the judge and jury could tell the difference, you would begin to see a lot of linguistic skepticism on the part of those who, based on their own ears, could tell the differences when, in fact, the defendants were claiming that they couldn't. And so a lot of times our work goes to the veracity of the claim that a person can't detect the dialect differences when, in fact, most of us do hear those differences, as your callers have beautifully demonstrated. Mm-hmm. They're tuning in on very slight linguistic differences that stand out to them based on their own linguistic experiences.
Well, we only have a few seconds left. I'd like to ask each of you a very quick question, very quick response, please. Is there anything about where language is going today that bothers you, Cindy?
That bothers me?
Yeah.
No. No, I celebrate languages, and I think that, one's identity through language is a positive thing. And I think all the multicultural interference or slang that comes along with it is something we should all celebrate.
John, in just a couple of seconds, any concerns?
I think it's so important that the United States be the nation that embraces as many languages as possible, and it's essential to us in a global economy. We have linguistic assets that are underutilized by virtue of the fact that so many of our immigrants bring languages and cultures from around the world. We're going to be competing with the Chinese, and right now, I've been consulting with them. Cindy works with Chinese scholars. they're trying to actually spread Chinese in ways that English already abounds throughout the world. So embracing languages from abroad, and English is not under threat. The United States is really a wonderful place from a linguistic point of view.
Got to leave it right there. John Baugh, thanks so much for being with us. Cindy Brandmeier, thank you. Great talking to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll hear highlights from former Vice President Al Gore's presentation and my conversation with him last Saturday at the St. Louis County Library. Archived versions of the program available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.